Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. My name is Amit Paul, and today we get to talk about, I don't know if we're going to talk about authenticity, but we're going to talk about shifting. I think we might talk about transformation, personal and otherwise, and we might talk about a lot of stuff. I don't know. We'll see. I'm going to leave it very open. Very welcome to the podcast, Carl Lindeborg.
Thank you, Amit. It's a pleasure to be in your podcast. I like it a lot. I've been listening to several episodes, so it's just an honor to be here.
Lovely. It's good to have you. It's fun. We have quite a few common acquaintances, and you've been this sort of the mythical Carl that's floating through. Oh, Carl says, like, Carl knows this stuff. And so it's fun to kind of get to connect and get to know these things. But I'll start you off, as I always do with my guests, part lazy, but also part letting you define yourself as you wish and as you see fit for whatever we're going to talk about. Carl Lindeborg, who are you?
Well, that's a wonderful question that I've been contemplating for at least 20 years in a kind of explorative way. So I'm wondering if you'd like to have a sort of shorter, more conventional answer, or a little bit more of an elaborated one.
Go take me on the adventure.
Well, the more conventional one that I would have definitely stayed with, 20 years ago would have been to say that, you know, my roles, like I'm a teacher, I'm a mentor, I'm a writer in the field of human growth and change. I'm also an organic farmer, a retreat owner based outside Stockholm in Sweden. And obviously I have many more roles. I'm a father of two kids that are now entering their teens. But, you know, there's obviously something more to my existence than my roles or, you know, thoughts or feelings or states that I could be in. And I've come to know that which goes beyond as two things. And one is just the consciousness that can hold all the different roles and all the different sensations and, you know, mental content and whatever might pass by. Because it's not like, you know, if you think about a thought, you can notice the thought. So it's not the thought noticing the thought, it's consciousness noticing the thought. And so I more often identify myself by being consciousness. Mm. And then there is a whole debate whether that consciousness is just purely local, so it arises in you and in your brain, or whether there is the potential that it actually is part of something more complex, like you're part of a field of consciousness to some degree. That's the one thing, that's the one flavor of a higher level of identification. And the second one, I think, could be called, you know, the authentic core. I have an authentic core which goes beyond all those roles. And I understand that as a deep set of values, a deep sense of purpose, you know, really innermost dreams, authentic dreams, maybe the unique gifts that I have. And that authentic core is not obvious always, especially earlier in life, right? You have to do a little bit of a discovery to find it. I think I'm consciousness. I think I'm authentic core. And I think I have loads of roles and contexts where I'm active. So I might stop there.
Do you want to, because I would really want to spend most of this time and this conversation to talk about the book, or like the writing that you are and about to do, maybe. And the book is called The Authentic Shift. But I'm wondering if, what's a good way to bring us into that book and what it's about? And maybe particularly, yeah. I would want to, like, I'm curious about why you wrote it, or like why you wrote it. So, like, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think there could be a couple of different entryways into that. One could potentially be my own journey and my background. Another one can be sort of what I, at least, and I think you and many others are seeing that the world needs right now. So where do you want to start?
Whatever feels more alive.
Well, I can just briefly say something where I'm coming from. So when I was about 20 years old, I sat in a garden in Aix-en-Provence. I remember this very clearly. And I made kind of a vision of my life and what I wanted to be and what I wanted to achieve. And that was before I came into business school. And that was sort of a very ambitious vision where I would be, you know, super successful. I would have a, you know, very ambitious career. You know, I would be good looking. I would have a lot of knowledge in different fields. I would have a, you know, good looking girlfriend and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And then basically I came to a conclusion. So how on earth am I gonna realize all of this? And I remember writing "sleep less."
Okay.
That was my conclusion. Yeah. In, you know, the 20-year-old version of myself. And basically, I did that. I worked very hard for many years. I went to business school. I figured out that the most prestigious job you could get was being a management consultant for a certain American firm. I figured also out that it was not enough to just study. You had to work next to your studies to build your CV. So I had an incredibly intense and also fun period where I did a lot of things. And I came out in the middle of the IT crash, 2001, 2002, but I still got the job. I think I was the only one hired from the business school that year to this firm. And I was thrown out into the world. I started to work in the US with very little experience, really. So it was really, it was pretty cool in one way, but it was also a lot of anxiety and very, very long hours. And I really, you know, worked hard, played hard, did all these kinds of things. And, you know, and after like 3 years into that, I had a project in Brussels where I had to work with cutdowns within a company. And I spent a winter there and it was just raining and I was there by myself. And I didn't have this vocabulary back then, but I definitely went into some kind of depression, some kind of emptiness where I didn't really know how to interpret all those feelings because it's always been, you know, the road had all been straight for me. But I realized in the end that I needed time to get off that treadmill and spend some time with myself to think, you know, is this really what life is all about? Because I had been successful in that little frame that I had focused on and I was not happy. In the end, I convinced my employer to get some leave. So I took 8 weeks. I took a backpack, no phone, no computer, and I went to Southeast Asia. And I came to Laos 3 days later after having worked like, you know, 80 hours per week. And I met a guy, Dutch executive, who brought me. He was going to a Buddhist temple and he brought me. And we came there and the monks were sitting in some kind of session singing together. It was just beautiful. And I basically thought, have I died? You know, is this because it was an incredible contrast to what I've been doing. Mm-hmm. But that was the turning point. You know, it opened up my eyes for something else. And I realized that I had lost my sense of purpose, my sense of playfulness, that had been very colored by the sort of cultural myth of success. And this is now 2004, so it's 20 years ago. And when I came home from this trip, I just changed my whole life. I quit the job, became a personal trainer in the gym, started to work with health, stopped partying at Stureplan, which is this party place in Sweden, and changed my eating, everything. And of course, it was almost like an overreaction. And it took me years to kind of find a new balance point where I really feel that I'm coming from what I find with my current knowledge being authentic in myself. And since then, I've been working with human growth, human development for 20 years and a lot out in the organization, mainly now focusing on the last 10, 12 years on leadership, change journeys, supporting companies becoming more purpose-driven, values-driven, not just talking about it, but actually practicing it. So that's the background where I'm coming from. And I've written a couple of books before, but it was 15 years ago. So now it was time for a new one. And because I, you know, connecting then to the other part in this, which is where the world is. Well, to me, we are in a very, very, very challenging place. And we are only seeing the beginning of it, I think. Where there's going to be a lot of friction between the old paradigm, and that is kind of causing all these side effects now, which and are not really at all taking the whole into account, but always sub-optimizing. And the new, well, the new powers or the new streams of thinking and acting, which sees the problem, which knows that we have to be much, much more holistic and question everything in our current culture, basically, to find a new way of being that is generative and that can take us where we want to go. And in order to do that, we have to grow our consciousness as human beings. And that's what this book is about, not just talking about it, but it's a guidebook based on my 20 years of experience working with people in change. Of how you could go about that, you know, from where you are. And I call it the authentic shift, inner development for a changing world. So I really think we have to work much more proactively, much more consciously on ourselves, because the world is changing so fast and it's getting just more and more complex.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And obviously I share that assessment and lens. And it's like, and actually, it's something I wanted to talk to you about that we also touched upon in our initial conversation. Is this? I have a complicated relationship to the word, to the words like inner development,
right?
And also this sort of this lens of like hierarchy or like progression, where it still seems like we're kind of. It's still kind of unidirectional in a way. Like, and I've read some of the stuff that you're basing, like some of the theory that you're basing the book on. And at the same time, it's like a tension point for me in terms of like a lot of the sort of ascent oriented or like plan oriented development. And I'm not saying that that's what you're saying only, but I'm saying that there's an element of that, like as if we could want to get out of it, or as if we, like, because those two things that you lifted before with consciousness and an authentic core, and like, and then of course if you look at like spiritual traditions and like Buddhism, they would argue that there's nothing at the core, and like there are all these like different breadcrumbs around of like a different way of approaching this than like planning your way out of it, or like, you know, taking conscious steps towards something that's higher. And I'm kind of
Well, I'm curious love that about, you are sort of in a way challenging that view. And you know, I'm not a technician on this. There are people that are very, very technical when it comes to what we can call adult development theory or vertical development theory, and how we can grow as human beings through our adult life. I'm more of a practitioner. So I base my conclusions of sort of having experienced thousands of people in growing and myself. I mean, I definitely use myself as a reference object. So I'm always careful to become rigid with models. I think some models are very helpful, but they can never explain the totality of an experience or so. I just want to say that first. Having said that, I think there are you know, there's always this complexity, well, not complexity, but challenge that some words get sort of hijacked. You know, you mentioned I have this difficult relationship with inner development. Mm-hmm. Yes, and why do you have that? Well, because you've heard that word in certain context where you sort of think things and feel things. And so the moment we use language, it's a simplification, right? And we need to remember that. So if I'm going to call you and describe just an amazing sunset when I'm at the beach, that experience is like 1,000 times richer than the one you will get through my language. So we're trying to put words on experiences that we have on the inside. Mm. And that's always problematic. But at least what I've seen in myself, and now everybody listening are not familiar with this model of growth, but basically what they say is that our inner meaning-making logic can change through life. And I think the best way of relating to that is to think of yourself 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And you just compare yourself, your current self, to that self. And most likely, you will find that, well, I'm functioning a bit different today. You know, I'm taking in what's happening around me in a different way. Potentially, I can hold more uncertainty. I'm less reactive. Potentially, I know a little bit more about myself. And that to me is what we're talking about. I mean, models or not, but there is something that can shift as we grow.
Yeah.
And I think all listeners can relate to that. I mean, if I compare to my 20-year-old self sitting there doing this vision, a lot has changed. I'm still myself, but I'm kind of something more as well. And this moreness is what I'm trying to get at. You know, who can I really be, you know, if I'm even more of myself? And I know in Buddhism, for instance, there are certain different schools in Buddhism, but of course there is the concept of emptiness. You know, in the end, everything is emptiness. But in some other schools, there is the emptiness and the fullness. And the fullness is kind of when you actually feel that you have, you know, you have a self, but you're not attached to that self. You know that you're also more than that self. But what I'm in my practice, I've meditated for 20 years. I like to sense both emptiness and fullness at the same time. And that's because it's so easy to get rigid that, you know, nothing that we see in form is actually for real, because, you know, everything is to some degree a visual illusion. But I'm not sure that it's helping us so much. So finding the right way into that is also, I think we have to find our own way into it. But I'm very much coming from experience. I mean, yes, use models, use theories, but, you know, try things out, sense, feel, experience, and draw conclusions for yourself. That's always my approach.
I love that you put it that way, because that's also what I got from our initial conversation, was that because I did, it's hard to know. As I was reading the book, it was hard for me to know. And because I have attention around these like theories, I was just like, I was projecting all kinds of opinions on you as the author. But then what I'm hearing you speak to is kind of you're presenting a map so that we can get to the edge of it. Or like there's a few steps here that we can probably take that's probably going to be useful for us, so that we can kind of get to those questions, or like keep asking those questions that are, they're not going to go away. Like it's about asking, or like you said before, like the current state is about us questioning everything and whatever we're doing, from, you know, if we can change the vantage point from where we are questioning. But it's not about stop questioning. It's not about getting there. It's about sort of taking those steps and keep moving into that uncertainty or something like that, into the terrain.
I agree with that. And I think, Amit, that the situation we're in now, I mean, life has always to some degree sort of just handled this thing for us. You know, we are experiencing different things on our life journey, and some of them will make us grow as human beings. And sometimes those are the most difficult things that we experience, where we suddenly have to stop, you know, we burn out, or we lose something important, and we have to stop, and we have to rethink certain things. And suddenly, you know, we're different when we come out on the other side. But the challenge today is that what we are created for in the standard version of ourselves biologically is, of course, a Stone Age environment. You know, nothing much has happened in our brain and our nervous system in thousands of years. And we now live in this accelerating science fiction-like environment where the logic is very different than the Stone Age sort of logic. And there is a tension between what we're created for in the, you know, in our standard version and what's now required of us, that I think a lot of people are sensing, and at least people that I work with, clients, and that tension comes, you know, from us, you know, being overwhelmed, being tired, losing our direction, running around sometimes on this treadmill, and losing some of that deeper purpose why we're here as human beings. And in the and at the same time, we need to solve challenges that are so, so much more complex than we had to do as a hunter and gatherer. So my take on this is that we may not necessarily have the time to just let life grow us, but I think it's helpful to see how can I grow within my potential maybe a little bit faster than if I just wait for life to handle it by being more proactive. And for the book, I present 9 different keys that can help people on this journey that I from experience know has helped a lot of people that I worked with. And I think some keys will speak more to some people and some keys will speak more to others, because it depends where you are in your growth and development. And but hopefully I hope that the book can help a lot of people. And it's written for people that want to make the shift in how they create meaning and how they navigate life, you know, beyond what we can call maybe the achiever paradigm, where we have been striving to reach goals and then we start to reach the next goal and we try to make things more efficient and we try to obviously be successful. But at some point, a lot of us come to a point that where we really ask, you know, what's the point of all this running? You know, is this just what life is supposed to be? How can I shift something in me and shift something in the way I live to create a richer experience? Not in terms of material things, but in terms of emotions, in terms of presence, in terms of the reward where I feel I'm actually contributing to something important beyond myself. And that's what I call the authentic shift. I think people could be authentic before that shift, but there is a point. And you know, traditionally, it might have been called the midlife crisis, where you just start asking yourself, you know, is this the only thing life is all about? Logistics and running and goals?
And then you get a sports car, right?
Yeah. Then you get a sports car or a younger husband or a younger wife or something like that. But it's never going to work, right? Because there is something speaking to you on the inside saying, hey, it's been great so far, but now it's time for something else as well. So it's not about saying that striving has been wrong in any way. It's been completely right, because that's exactly what I needed to do at that point. But it's, you know, life development is cyclical. And at some point, that cycle of experience and consciousness, I believe for many people, will need to shift into a new cycle. And when we resist that, and when we don't see the signs, and we choose not to see the signs, we will not be happy. And we will be, as I was at least, we may be depressed, or we may just sense that Life Lacks meeting, and we may get distract ourselves by, and that's the problem today. There are so many distractions that can take you away from those inner, that inner voice that knows what you really need. Just open your phone and you can get lost for hours. So it's not super easy always.
Mm. Now you're getting all the hard questions, because these are the questions that I'm sitting with myself. But like, so I'm hearing you describe, I agree with like the way that it seems, or like in terms of, you know, and like when I stumbled into these theories about like 5-8 years ago or something like that now, I was like, oh, good. Here's something else to strive for. Like there was just, I flipped the achievement thing from this one material wealth or like whatever you would call like outward success, and then to another thing. Yeah. Because there is a ladder and I need to climb and I can be here. And then like you do, when you give this workshop, sometimes at some point I was giving the sort of just jokingly kind of said, you know, we described the Keegan's 5 steps and or something like that, which is one of those. And I was like, it's really good because all of those other suckers that are out there that are on the lower, you know, it's kind of, you position yourself somewhere in that ladder, and then you start thinking and looking at people and there are, and I think that's part of it, of course, but then.
But you know what, just saying something there, yeah. I've seen that happen many times when you present a model like this. But of course, we relate to the model based on, you know, if you believe in the model, we're going to relate to the model based on the stage of development and consciousness where you're at. So if you have some achiever left, then that achiever is going to come out.
Yes.
If you're more into sort of, you know, expert, which is like, oh, I want to know all the, you know, what's the logic and who's, you know, is this proven? And if you may have passed on, you may say, oh, well, now I understand what's happening with me, because I like, and I've seen that happen many, many times, which to me actually to some degree confirms some of these logics. I was heading somewhere else.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I was also thinking, I stumbled into Eric Fromm's work, and he has this like great saying that we have modal confusion. We're trying to solve being needs by having stuff, which I think is a really sort of nice short form for saying something. I was headed where you're headed as well, which is like this, there's like this new thing to attain. And I wonder sometimes, in a way, like you were saying before, it's like this new thing to attain becomes a portal to something else, so that it becomes a portal towards something. And then at some point you'd be able to relax. But I'm wondering, you know, is it a detour sometimes? Like, is it really needed? You know, is it human nature or is it just cultural conditioning? You know, like, you know?
Yeah, well, you have to be more specific, I think. Like, okay. I think the concept is interesting with detour, but what would you mean? Could you give an example?
No, I mean, from one perspective, I can see the utility of having dug into these theories from my point of view. First, sort of placing myself at the top of them, and then kind of finding more like digging more, like more nuance, and like discovering how I was stuck in them. And then kind of, so they've helped me. These developmental theories, like they really helped me, and now I'm like but what I'm sitting with at the moment is like, is that how is it necessary to, because what I feel like on the other side of them right now is like when I work with people and when I interact with people and so forth, sometimes those theories would get in the way because I would be like, oh, they are only here. And so I am at this like higher step. And so therefore, there's like a certain arrogance that is very easy to, it's not what they're saying, the theories themselves, but it's easy to land in that arrogance. And that has been sort of, again, like an unlearning step that you need to do. So I'm just wondering like if there are.
No, but yeah.
That's what I mean by detour. Like,
Yeah, but I see what you mean. And that's why I'm also saying I'm not a technician. I don't hang out in these circles, basically. So I might not be the right person speaking about these models, but I just used it because I see there is some helpfulness in it that I've seen. But I agree with you.
From the practitioner's point of view, because I mean, that's kind of where the rubber hits the road anyways, like, you know.
Because one pitfall, I agree with you. I think that could definitely be the pitfall of arrogance. And that arrogance just confirms the model to me to some degree. You know, it's natural at a certain level of consciousness to sort of feel that you have to promote yourself or your ego, and you can do that any way you want. You know, you can compare to your neighbor, whatever, and you can compare who knows these models best, or you can say who's most spiritual and who can meditate the longest. And I mean, it's everywhere. And I think I could have written the book without mentioning the model even, because I wrote a book 15 years ago called Your Brilliant Self, Creating Life from Inside Out. Definitely overlaps this book's in terms of focus. And I didn't know anything about these models. And so, yeah, I don't want to get trapped into us, getting stuck here, because it's not really where I'm coming from. I used the model, I described it, I think I only used like 10 pages in the book or something. And then I go into practice. And the practice is more targeted towards helping people become more of themselves, and helping people create lives that feel more meaningful, deep, and to make, you know, maybe even more real impact in the world around them. That's been my purpose that I feel inside.
Well, let's get into the book more, because you're making it. You're kind of getting the curious, or like the questions that I'm sitting with in terms of how we get people to ask these questions in an open and a relaxed way, without them feeling that they are not sufficient, or like without them create, like without this idea of that it's a lack in people that they need to, in order to, you know, it's an invitation to curiosity or something like that, rather, which is kind of the spirit that I'm feeling in your inquiry. But you've divided the book into three overalls, like modules, if you say, and then underneath those there are the keys. Just take us into kind of where you...
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes say that the book is like a leadership program in book form, right? Mm. And the first part I call foundation. And because part of the book is sort of really going deep into yourself. And if you do that with a, you know, very tough critic present, or just being not so used to really sensing into yourself beyond just this normal mind flow of thought, that might be difficult to do. So the first part, foundation, is more about how to grow and cultivate awareness of how you think, how you feel, how you sense things, cultivating your presence, and also building what I call the climate for growth, an inner climate for growth. I mean, it's like, you know, when you want to invest in your own growth, it's like being in a gardener, basically. I mean, you need to establish conditions that makes the ground fertile. And I know a lot of people, and I've had the same challenge, that are very tough on themselves, and there are of course reasons for that. It's a pattern that have evolved, but it's also a pattern that I think we have to relate to differently and unlearn to some degree when we want to go deeper. I mean, we have to find a place where we're more kind to ourselves and more allowing, more curious, more open, because that critical voice that a lot of us have inside, it's very simplistic. It's based on history. It can't see the whole beauty of yourself. And if we listen to it too much, we limit ourselves. And we can listen to it. We can say, "Hey, I'm listening. Okay, thank you for that information. I see where you are coming from. But I'm also more than that." So that's the first part of the book, is a lot about that, and also about knowing how your brain works. That when you when you want to approach complexity, which we all are very complex systems. We cannot just trust our left brain to lead the way, which is this sort of linear, logical, rational. I mean, it's strong in that field. We need the right brain. I think we need the brain and the heart. So I call it balanced intelligence and how to cultivate that before you sort of venture deeper into yourself.
What's your, you get to answer if you want to, what's your relationship to that inner critic today? Where does he or she live in your?
Yeah, I, it's interesting. You know, I used to be very critical of myself. I competed in tennis and I remember saying awful things to myself on the tennis court. Also in my these earlier sort of very much achievement-oriented years, I was very tough on myself. But gradually, and this is also why I believe this stuff works, it doesn't arise very often. And when it does, I'm usually quite aware of it and just say, oh, I'll chill. I mean, relax. And it is, to be honest, it's not very present anymore. And that is, at the same time, I'm much more aware of what I'm thinking. So than I used to be when I was aware of it. But I've done a lot of work on myself for 20 years, and one thing that I had to focus a lot on at a certain period was sort of opening my heart. I realized at some point that I had closed myself heart-wise, and I was very much in my head, and that's also where the critic lives. So by coming more into my heart. You know, processing certain things that happened to me in my life. I think that the kind of inner kindness and patience have grown. Of course, I can sometimes be critical, but it's not at all as it used to be. And also saying that the critic sometimes has a point. Like it's not like we should fight it or get rid of it completely. I mean, it can say, hey, in that meeting, what you said was not very nice. And you're like, oh, that's actually true. Yeah, I need to call that guy, you know, and just talk. You know, you see, like, so sometimes the critic has a point. It's more like how it functions in the totality of our own inner system that usually is out of whack.
Yeah, and I mean, and just that, like, inner system versus oneself or something like that. I mean, even that perspective is quite significant.
Yeah.
And then, but take us on into the second, second part.
Yeah, so that's the foundational part. And it consists of like lots of reflective questions and practices that you can do to actually do the work. Because if we're going to basically rewire how we function in our brains also, we need to practice. The second part I called deepening, which is, you know, now we go into ourselves and we start thinking. And the first question that I bring up is actually, I don't know if you noticed that when you read the book, but it's actually, who are you? Mm-hmm. I mean, who are you really? Mm-hmm. And I think it's such a rich question to start thinking about. Who am I really? I mean, of course, I am all these concrete things, but I'm something more. And what is that more for you? And a part of that has to do with also, in the end, getting some more distance to your self-image. We form a self-image through life. The brain has thoughts and truths about who we are or who we're supposed to be or what we're good at or not so good at. And when we grow, that self-image tend to lag behind. You know, we're seeing us as something we used to be, and we may not always have an easy time to see our future self, the potential we have inside of ourselves. So that's what we start with. You know, how can we get to know our self-image? How can we upgrade that? And then beyond that, we the other two keys there are kind of really going deep on your values. Who are you in terms of deeper values? And which is maybe more complex than some people talk about. I mean, a lot of people talk about values, but But there is some complexity here. I mean, some values are actually driven by fear, I would say, that may be cloaked into something else. I mean, you can have ambition as a value, but is it driven by performance anxiety, or is it driven from your really sort of, you know, your sense of joy and purpose? And there's also the dynamic between different values. It's really an inner ecosystem. And then the last part in that middle part of the book is about the sources of meaningfulness, which I think is important to think about today, because there's so much stuff out there. And what I'm going to focus on, if I'm going to feel good and be stimulated, I think to some degree need to overlap with a certain sense of deeper purpose. So what's my purpose? What's my, not just in terms of what do I want to do that feels purposeful, but also how do I sense myself as a human being within a much larger context? I mean, I think sometimes we are in ourselves and we get, you know, this is my world and I'm inside my head. And you're like, yeah, but you're one of 8 billion people on a planet that is just a tiny speck in this huge cosmos. And, you know, and we came out of this big bang, I think it's like 14 billion years ago. Like, it's just healthy to get perspective. And that's also what we do there, like really connect to the, who am I in the larger scheme of things? And hopefully during that middle part, we renew our contact with our inner compass. So when we come out into the outer world, we can be more intentional and direct ourselves and our lives in a way that feels enriching. And to me, that's always almost aligned with making a positive contribution in the world. And the last part of the book is called Realization, which is, okay, so what do I now go with this inner knowledge that I may have accumulated? And that has two parts. One is really working with visioning and creating visions that are in line with who you are, but also sort of bold. I think we all have a lot of potential, and it doesn't have to be a lot around what do I want to have, but also a lot, I would say, more about who do I want to be. You can have all kinds of things, and you can have the best job ever, but if you're not happy with who you are, then what's the point? So to me, vision has a lot to do with who do I want to be when I am myself, and when I'm living in a way that is authentic. And the last key in that part is called the hero's journey, which is really about realizing things. It's usually when we grow and change and try new avenues, there's usually resistance to some degree. We face challenges, and the hero's journey is just a metaphor of that. And how do I overcome these things? And that involves, you know, looking at your own shadow and some deeper work as well.
And you did answer this question once already today, but I'm going to ask it again anyways, because there's something juicy around sort of where in relationship to yourselves,
be careful right.
Using plural, right? This book, like who are you now that you've written it? And like now that you're putting it out into the world, and like, and who do you want to become? Or like, yeah.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, on a very concrete and practical level, I think I'm changing. I've spent 10 or 12,000 hours of my life facilitating groups that in developmental context, especially in companies. That's a lot of hours. And I think I came to a point where I felt like, yeah, I can do this. I'm fairly good at it. It creates impact, I think, to some degree. But I also felt that I wanted a new challenge. And having written this book, and also translated it into English. It's the first book that I translated into English. Mm. I hope to reach out broader. It's not easy with a book because there's so much stuff out there, but it seems like the people that are reading it are very positive, and it makes a difference for people. And so we're looking into US and UK and India to launch it there. And And I hope to be maybe more of a, these labels are always difficult, because if I called myself consultant before or corporate trainer, it would be more like a teacher and mentor and writer, and to reach much broader crowd. That's where I sense my energy is. And I said to, as I said to you before, I hope also to continue to writing, that that this book could be potentially the first book in a trilogy and the next book will probably be more around how we grow those abilities to really navigate systemically in the world, which I think is so important. Just look at the, you know, politicians having a debate. It's very often very simplistic, black and white. There's very little sort of systemic awareness. And so hopefully the next book can be about that, and not just write about it, but actually also once again a guidebook for how you can grow those capacities in yourself.
Actually, I have two questions. I'm going to ask the weird question first. Let's see if this...
Oh, I like weird questions.
What if you're... when you said teacher, I was just like, what are you employing the role of teacher to do for you, the bigger you, the consciousness and the awareness, like the authentic core?
Well, so good question. Yes. So this is how I experience it. I experience my inner world in a way where I really feel that the universe is asking me to do something. And whatever that universe, you know, but it's not like God said this, but it's more like I kind of very much follow where the energy is. And sometimes I'm trying to do something and it's just impossible. No matter how much effort I put into it, nothing happens, right? And sometimes there is this flow and things go easy and opportunities come. And if I try to interpret that in myself, I kind of feel that the universe is asking me to to take that role. You know, personally, I would be quite happy to sit in a cave and meditate, but I think the universe is asking me to be more active and to help and support people, groups, contexts that really want to grow and change and shift, so that we together can form a much, much better and more thriving world than we have today. And then there seems to be a teacher role for me to take, since I've been kind of, well, I've had a kind of a teacher role. I didn't call myself a teacher before for 20 years. But so whatever label we use, I want to be a catalyst for meaningful, positive growth that can benefit the whole, basically. And if we call that being a teacher or a mentor or a writer or a catalyst or change agent or whatever, that's just labels.
And then in terms of where you are right now, because a trilogy that kind of implies also some sort of directionality, and like there's an idea that's there that's bigger than this, but what do you rest your attention on right now? Like what is most important to you, or like what's important, I would say?
That's a great question. What's important? That's all. I mean, that's a question we all should be asking ourselves every day. What's really important? What's really important to me, I mean, now I'm repeating myself, but it is to see if I can contribute in a larger scale than just working with a group and then the next one and then the next one. And I don't know exactly how that could be shaped or what that future looked like. So right now I feel very open. I'm curious. I feel open. I think I'm in a shift in my life, moving maybe from one development phase into another one. So what's important to me is to be open, but also to do some things. You know, you can't just sit and wait and hope things will show up if you don't do anything. So I'm doing certain things to get that moving. So that's one thing. The second thing I think is to not make violence on myself, which by that I mean not to create, oh, I'm going to do this and then I'm going to do it even if I work too hard or if I, you know, get too much run by my left brain, like, okay, I'm going to plan this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to, so I hope I can stay open, curious, adaptive, and aware through this change. But you know, Amit, more and more, I've come to a place where I don't have many goals. I have intentions, I have hypotheses, I'm trying to sense what the universe is asking of me. But my old self would have set up, you know, 4 different goals, and in 3 months you should be there. And so I don't do that anymore. Like, I could be there, I could be there, I could, you know, I could change tomorrow if we run an organic farm and retreat here. We've spent 12 years on that, but you know, I could also sell it tomorrow. Like, if there's something else, you know, calling me. So I don't have much attachment anymore to specific outcomes or goals. I put things in motion. I'm trying to stay true to what I feel called to do. And then I'm very curious to see what happens.
I can relate. And there was something around when you say that you're going to stop doing violence to yourself, or like, I mean, the opposite of that, I guess, would be to do kindly also to yourself, like, some sort of omni kindness aspect, and that I have a really strong, that was a nice resonance.
But you know what? Finding that place, which has come to me the last few years more and more, of feeling you have a purpose, you have intentions, you put things in motion, but not being so attached to outcome, it's very liberating. It's like, okay, this didn't happen the way I wanted to. Okay, that's okay. Like, of course, I can be sad or disappointed sometimes, but much less than I used to be. And I think, yeah, we avoid a lot of suffering on the inside when we get a little bit less attached to outcome.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know. My experience is that regardless of what I wanted to happen or thought I wanted to happen, something happened.
Yes.
And so there's also like, that's where I placed the curiosity when you said that. It's like, it's also about sort of discovering what actually happened, because it might not have been in the direction that I was looking, but something certainly happened. Like,
yes,
you know,
something happened or something was learned.
Yeah. I'm curious about, actually, because you mentioned the hero's journey before, and that's like another, maybe that's like a note, almost a note to end on, but this relationship between kind of the one and the many, and the hero and the many heroes. And we're talking today on International Women's Day, and like this whole idea of like diversity of perspectives and diversity of gender and diversity of, you know, whatever life experience or whatever it might be. But I just to sort of, this is a big jump from where we were just a moment ago, but there's something around the single hero versus the many heroes, and like this thriving future for who, you know, and or like from, you know, an organic farm in Sweden is very different from a majority of the population on the world and so forth. So like, I don't know if you wanted to just kind of philosophize or think about the individual systemic relationship a little bit longer, like from the perspective of, like, you know, diversity was the word that I had a curiosity around when we talk about the hero, you know, like capital H, maybe. It's easy to misconceive.
It is. I mean, well, actually, the notion of hero's journey was, I think, formed by Joseph Campbell, who studied all the it's interesting because you say diversity. He studied myths from all over the world. So he was very much studying diversity. And what he found was that there were certain elements in these myths that kept coming back no matter what culture you went to, and, you know, cultures that never have been in contact with each other. And he called that actually the monomyth. Like, there seems to be a an archetypal pattern that comes back in storytelling. Mm. And that's what he called, he called that the hero's journey. And he said that it seems these myths are symbolic for human development. So I do think that we all have a kind of a hero's journey to make, but it doesn't have to be that we do it ourselves. More than ever before, we need each other. And so building connections and exploring different perspectives and really promoting diversity, I think, is more important than ever before. So yes, I think we do have to make our hero's journey on one degree. Nobody can make my hero's journey, and nobody can make yours, whatever that means to you. But I think, the change that I think both you and I are in our own ways thinking about for the world, and a lot of people that have been on your podcast, will not happen by, it's not going to obviously be driven by the current paradigm of thought and power. It can never do that. So who are going to build the new paradigm? Mm. Well, it's not the sort of power centers of today. And it's not our sort of mainstream politicians, it seems like, that are so stuck in these stories that are now outdated, badly outdated. It's maybe not our biggest corporations either, even though there are a lot of corporations doing better things. But I think it's really a grassroots movement where people like you and I and people listening to this podcast and many, many, many more people across the globe are seeing the need to go on a hero's journey, not by ourselves. We do our own, but we're also doing it together. And each journey has a different flavor, but they will interrelate, and we can sort of grab each other's hands to some degree. And if that movement of shift in meaning-making and consciousness that gets transformed into action gets big enough, I believe it will create sooner or later a tipping point. But that can never come from inside the current paradigm. It needs to come from people. And it needs to come from people from all over the globe. And I think we are the ones who are going to do it. You and I, people listening to this, and millions of other people. No one else. That's how I see the hero's journey. We all have to make our own flavor of it, but we do it together.
Yeah. I caught sight of something that I haven't really seen before, but you said, like, when you were describing it, it's like the Campbell's work is about sort of the storytelling, and it is archetypical and it's symbolic, and that there is like an inspirational quality in like set sort of like inspirare, like that Latin, like the it fills you with the spirit, or like actually pulls you towards something, and pulls you out of your wherever you are right now. So it just opens you up to those questions that you were invoking in the beginning, perhaps, and then these aspects of movement and shift, and both movement and shift. I mean, not necessarily, what I'm hearing you speak to is like there's not necessarily a direction, a pre-prescribed direction of them, but the movement and the shifting, the movementing and the shifting itself is
yeah, sort of the... and exactly, and if people are not familiar with his work, the first part of the hero's journey, as Campbell calls this, is the call to adventure. And if you look at the myths, or if you look, if you've watched, let's say, Lord of the Rings or something, I mean, there is a call to adventure. Something happens, or something changes, or some new person is coming in, and suddenly you are called to adventure. Frodo in the Lord of the Rings, he was not very happy being called to adventure, but suddenly you are called to adventure. And I think right now a lot of us are called to adventure. I mean, to change and challenge the current paradigm. And then what happens when you accept that call in the end is that you get help, you get support. There are guardians. You don't have to do it yourself, but you still have to move over that first, and Campbell called this the crossing of the first threshold. There's always a threshold that you have to cross on your hero's journey. And that can be, I don't know, changing from one job to another, training yourself in something new, being a bit uncomfortable in a new situation. You know, what's the threshold that you have to cross in your life right now? And some of us have already crossed the threshold, and we're kind of exploring on the other side, which he calls the road of trials, and we're on our way. And some of us, I am sure, are feeling there are some calls to adventure. There is a threshold. Do I dare to cross it or not? And then it comes back to this interplay between fear and courage within ourselves.
Lovely. Is there something else that I should have asked that we didn't get to talk about?
Well, I'm sure we could talk for a very long time about a lot of different things, but I think we touched upon many things. No, I cannot really think of anything in specifically like that. Do you think of anything?
There's maybe a piece of that we didn't talk about around. Might be a piece of sort of in terms of the Stone Age brain versus what's needed right now, or like our hardware and and its interaction with its surroundings, This notion of, and I think we brought it in very briefly, but like this notion of the culture versus what the limits of the hardware is, like what our the operating system. I don't like machine analogies because I think it's time that we move away from this sort of computational idea of consciousness. I don't think that's how it doesn't seem to be how it works. But still, like, I don't know if there's something to be said there, because I agree with you on one level that it is a grassroots movement, and I like on another level I see there's so many systemic forces that are built to keep us stuck or keep us in place.
Yes. But I totally agree with you. I think the systemic burden that we have to deal with is huge, and it goes from, I mean, everything from how our capitalist society is built. I mean, I work with senior leaders in some of our biggest companies that really want to change things and that want to do things differently, but they need to deliver on quarterly, profits. And it's almost like their hands are tied to a certain degree. Another thing that I'm quite worried about is, Karl Marx said, at least he's said to be having said, that religion is the people's opium. Well, we're not, at least in Sweden, we're not much for religion, but we're quite busy with social media and our smartphones, and to me that's the new opium. If you want to make people passive and make people distracted from what's really important, give them a smartphone and a lot of apps that are built to manipulate your brain into certain things, and that are built to make use of systems like your reward systems, with how the dopamine in you works. And in one way, we need to remember that we are competing. I also have a smartphone. I'm actually present on social media, but we are competing with the world's smartest, most knowledgeable brain manipulators every day. And that's another kind of systemic structure that can be used for good, but it can also take us away from mobilizing energy to act and to get together and go out to do things, real things in the world, because we get this false sense that because I liked a few things and I comment here and there, I've made a difference. Or potentially you made a little bit difference. But it's also, I think it's often an illusion, and we need real action, real behavioral change. We need to do things in the real world and not just in the virtual world. We can make use of it. But it's a big challenge because our brains are so easy to manipulate.
And I guess that's also like the point of your book. I mean, with each key, there are several sort of practices and several different sort of aspects to a particular key. And there are several meditations and practices. And like, it is a workbook, as you've been saying. I agree. I think, a movement, when you move your thumb to click like, that's very different from transporting yourself down to the town square and going out and protesting something, or, you know, trying to build a company or whatever. I mean, this is actually a point to moving, actually physically moving.
Yes. And as you said, with the book, my intention has been to try to avoid kind of quick fix solution, but actually create something that I actually know could be life-changing for people, since I've been working with this for so long. If the reader, you know, is inspired and chooses to take on the work, because we still need to do the work. And that's not, you know, when we get inspired by something on Instagram, nothing really shifts, right? Like we click on something and we move on. But this book is built to hopefully help the reader stay with deep questions. And I tell people that read it, that, you know, spend 6 months with it, spend 12 months with it. Don't rush, you know, read a few pages. It's the quality of your state while you're reading and reflecting that is more important than trying to finish the book as soon as possible. And I think we have this a catch 22, it's called in English, where at least a lot of people that I work with, they say, well, I don't have time to read a book. I need to do X, Y, and Z. But it's actually not just reading a book, but it's actually, you know, your practice, your meditation, your, you know, meeting with your best friends, whatever it is, that in the end makes you feel better. And in the end, make you access a different way of viewing yourself in your life that help you reorganize your daily life in a way where you suddenly get more time. So it's like, we don't have time to get more time. And we have to break that, I think. Things are coming for a lot of people, I think, it's spinning so fast. So we cannot just keep accelerating. We need different logics of how to approach our everyday lives, I think.
Yeah.
Many of us.
That's lovely. And I mean, to your book point, I think you could read probably, you could take one of the keys or even one of the sub keys, so to say, and just do that and do that. And you're going to be moving.
Yes. Yeah. So it is a comprehensive book. It's 400 pages long. It may not be for everyone, but I really wanted to do something that I believe can make a real change. And I had some pre-readers, and they like, this is good. Just keep writing. And so it has 9 keys, and each key, as you said, has what I call a resource. So we have. Yeah, so we have 9 keys and 3 resource per key. So 27 resources that you could cultivate.
Where can they find you if they want to work with you? Where can people interact? Where can they find the book?
Well, the best place to find me is through my website. So it's carl.lindeborg.com. There's also information about the book there and other resources that are free on the website to try out or read. The book can be bought on the internet web shops in Sweden, Netherlands, some countries in Europe. And we are now working on UK, US, and other markets. But we're happy to send you the books if you contact me through the website. I do some writing. Every week I write something new on Medium. I'm a little bit almost reluctantly present on Instagram, but I'm trying to do some qualitative stuff there. And also my network since before is mainly on LinkedIn. So there I'm also active.
I will provide the links to the website and the Medium and the LinkedIn, and then people can kind of make their way from there. They're in the show notes, clickable. Thank you so much for taking the time, Carl, for letting me ask you hard questions.
No, I think they were great questions. Thank you, Amit. And thank you for your work, speaking about that we have to do it together. I think you make a great contribution.